In baseball, there's only a handful of iconic players, and at the top of the list is the name Willie Mays. He played 22 seasons for the New York Giants, the San Francisco Giants, and the New York Mets, as well as the Birmingham Black Barons and the Negro Leagues. A Hall of Famer, Willie Mays is considered the greatest all-around talent in the game's history. His numbers confirm that. Rookie of the Year, two-time MVP winner, career batting average of .302, 3,283 hits, 660 home runs, 24 All-Star appearances, and 12 Gold Gloves. For me, Willie Mays has a personal importance. When I launched Sports Byline USA in October 1988 as the first national sports talk network, Willie Mays was my first ever guest. He was in the studio with me. We weren't good friends, but we knew each other from my broadcasting TV and radio in San Francisco. At spring training, I'd listen to Willie share his wisdom and advice to players and others. It was an education. I'll never forget that very first hour-long in-studio interview with Willie, and also I'll never forget what he said to me when I walked him out the door. I asked him, "Willie, why did you go to such an effort to do the show?" He simply said, "I like the way you treat people, and I want to be able to look back someday and say I played a part." Willie Mays, forever a gentleman and a pioneer. Willie has joined forces with author John Shea. He's a very well-respected baseball columnist as well as an author, to write in Mays' own voice the book 24, Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid. This book is full of poignant and timeless stories and reflections from Willie, as well as tales from many others who played major league roles in his career and his life. Co-author of 24, John Shea, is with us. I mentioned that Willie is one of the most iconic baseball players ever. John, what makes him so?
Boy, Ron, thanks for having me. Giving me chills. This is the best introduction in the history of broadcasting. he's a five-tool player. He's got the sixth tool. There's nothing he couldn't do. We could have a debate all day whether his base running was better than his hitting, which was better than his fielding, which was better than his arm, was better than slugging. Who knows? They were all top of the charts. And I asked Willie, for the purpose of the book, I said, "What are you most proud of? Because you have 660 home runs." Everything you just mentioned, a lot of offensive stuff there. But he said, "My defense. That's what I'm most proud of, because it all starts with defense. That is going to turn more games than anything I do at the plate." Now, that's pretty remarkable for a guy with 660 home runs.
Tell me a little bit about his roots in Alabama.
Boy, born in 1931, right outside Birmingham in Westfield, Alabama, which no longer is there. It was an old mill town. He settled in Fairfield, Alabama. His dad worked in the mills. And we're talking the Jim Crow South. We're talking the Great Depression, poverty, segregated town, all the way. It was illegal for blacks and whites to play with each other all the way up until 1964. Martin Luther King called it the most segregated city in the country. But Willie didn't think that way. Willie said, "I have family, I have friends, I have food on the table, and I have ball fields." And that's all he needed. He didn't care that there wasn't enough money in his pocket. And he overcame all that and persevered. I mean, obviously there were struggles in the community such as that, but he played for what he thought was going to be the best team and the final team he ever played for, the Birmingham Black Barons. And 18, 19, and then as a 20-year-old, the Giants sign him. So he plays 48, 49, and 50. The final Negro League World Series, Mays is the center fielder for Birmingham. So the Giants sign him and send him to an all-white team in an all-white league. So imagine that culture shock coming out of the Negro Leagues as a teenager. And then a year after graduation, he's a center fielder in the Polo Grounds for the New York Giants. So the story is quick-paced. And for Willie, and the bottom line is it was a wonderful career, but an exemplary life. So there are two facets to the book.
As I mentioned, Willie Mays and John Shea co-authoring this book. Tell everybody about the format of how it's presented.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a format that I haven't seen in any other book. It's basically me putting it on the tee for Willie and getting out of his way and watching him hit it out of the ballpark. Pretty much every page you see Willie's presence in terms of his commentary, and they're bold-faced. Willie and I, we did the math. We spent over 100 hours together for this project, and I interviewed, beyond that, more than 200 people, Negro League teammates and childhood buddies, and it could be Hall of Famers, 30-plus of them, and you know, commissioners, managers, broadcasters, presidents I interviewed, artists, musicians. Everybody seemed to have a Willie Mays story, and everybody called back. And that was the fascinating thing about this, and because everybody seemed to want to be involved. And the beauty of the book is it's all exclusive material, none of it taken from another book or a periodical or a magazine or anything like that, microfiche, anything from the past. It's all new material. There's no bibliography. And it was an honor and amazing to be able to write history that hadn't been recorded in many ways. All this storytelling that Mays and the others tell now is something I had never known, and nobody else had, because it's all new information.
Number 24 is, of course, significant, and that was the number that he wore, and so that's where the title of the book comes from. And one of them is Respect Everyone Like Your Teammate, the story of the absurdity of racism. And Willie says, make a difference by teaching kids how to respect people of all backgrounds and races. Set an example so they can set an example. How was he treated when he was coming up as a kid?
Well, he always says people took care of him. From his dad in the early going, and it's not like his parents stayed together very long. They were teenage parents. It was mostly his mom's younger sisters, Willie's aunts, who took him in and took care of him. And, you know, friends and relatives. And then in baseball, you know, obviously he's in the Negro Leagues playing with these grown men in their 20s and 30s who also looked out for him. It seemed all along the way, you know, people, it was important for people to look out for him. And then, of course, Monty Irvin, his first roommate, once he got to the Giants in 51, was just a wonderful. I mean, Monty Irvin, the great Negro League player and the Hall of Famer, who had great seasons with the Giants. And people thought he was going to be Jackie Robinson before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. And then Leo Durocher, of course, his all-time favorite manager, took him under his wing and never scolded him or hollered at him. And, you know, we know Leo was kind of a rough guy. But with Willie, it was just a gentle approach, and that just worked beautifully for Willie. And it was a perfect manager and perfect time. You remember he was 0 for 12 and 1 for 25 when he began his career. The only home run, the only hit a home run off Lawrence Bond. But it was Leo who, while Willie crying at his locker, came up to him and said, "Hey, listen, we don't need you to hit. We just need you to do what you're doing out there in the outfield, just chasing everything down." And from that day on, Willie did start hitting.
I loved what he said about his dad. He said, "My dad was the guy who called me all the time saying, 'Junior, don't say too much now, because I know how you are when you start saying the wrong things.'" Tell me about his dad.
It's the only time in the book that he mentions the word junior. It's the only time ever I actually heard Willie say that his dad called him junior.
Also, the guys with the Birmingham Black Barons, he gives them a lot of credit, too. He says, "The Birmingham guys prepared me to do that," in other words, to go forward. Tell me about him playing Negro League baseball.
Well, he was just a teenager in high school. His best sport was football. He was this great quarterback. His second best sport was basketball. He was a phenomenal shooting guard. Baseball was number three. So imagine how good he was. But his high school team had a football. His high school had a football team. It had a basketball team. It did not actually have a baseball team. So kids that age didn't play for the school. They played, you know, for the town, the region, and then they traveled and played other areas. But in Willie's, for Willie, he didn't need that. He went straight to the Negro Leagues, you know, as a high school ball player. And, I mean, he can still go around the horn and talk about, you know, Jimmy Zapp and Bill Greeson and Artie Wilson and Alonzo Perry and Ed Steele and Sammy C. Williams, all these guys that he just remembers like it was yesterday, looked out for him. You know, even, you know, going as far as you know, Piper Davis, his manager, who around Birmingham is a god. And, you know, Piper made sure that Willie would room on the road with the next day's starting pitcher, knowing that starting pitcher probably wouldn't go out. So just to protect Willie and prevent him from going out, the starting pitcher was always in and had to look out for Willie, make sure he didn't go out. But they were like big brothers to him. And you know, to this day, he'll, you know, he's just never forgotten any of those guys.
In about 30 seconds.
Yes. By the way, they should have been in the big leagues. They were that good. But, you know, Major League Baseball had quotas and obviously most teams at the time, you know, weren't even accepting any. So, it's unfortunate that, so Willie kind of, they lived their life through Willie when he became, superstar and the Hall of Famer. That was my guy. So they really looked out for him and followed him throughout the career.
The name of the book is 24, about lessons that were learned along the way by Willie Mays, and it's co-authored by John Shea. This is an excellent book. We're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline Book Corner. And Willie once said, "I was very lucky when I was a child. My family took care of me and made sure I was in early at night. I didn't get in trouble. My father made sure that I didn't do the wrong thing. I've always had a special place in my heart for children and their well-being." We continue across the country and around the world. It's good to have you with us on America's sports talk show, Sports Byline. John Shea has joined us on Sports Byline USA. He's an outstanding baseball columnist, but has written a number of other books about baseball. And he has co-authored, along with Willie Mays, in Mays' own voice, a book called 24. It's an outstanding look at the Hall of Famer's life, his career, and all that he has done in baseball and outside of it as well. Tell me a little bit about the path to the major leagues for him.
Boy, it was rough. He went from the Negro Leagues to the Trenton Giants, a Class B league in the Giants farm system, and he's the only black man on the team, the only black man in the league. Some of the games were below the Mason-Dixon line, and he got razzed pretty good because of the color of his skin. And this is only 3 years after Jackie Robinson broke into the big league, so Willie was hearing a lot of the stuff that Jackie heard. And, of course, Branch Rickey told Jackie, "Hey, those first 2 years, keep it to yourself. Don't go after anybody. It'll pass." And Jackie, it was tough, but he did it, and by the third year, he could express himself and be himself. And that's exactly what Willie's dad told Willie. He said, "Hey, keep it to yourself. Don't pop off. Don't charge anybody. You're going to hear this stuff." And the Birmingham Black Baron teammates, the same thing. They warned him about all this because they had been trailblazers throughout their careers, and they knew what was going to come for Willie. But by the second professional season, he's in Minneapolis, a Triple-A team. And by the way, that Trenton Giants team, Willie said, "This isn't even close to the talent we had in Birmingham." So then he goes to Minneapolis, a Triple-A team, and it was integrated, and it was a lot more fun, and the fans accepted him a lot more. And he's hitting .477 in late May, thinking, "This is great. I'm going to be here all year. I just love this place." And Leo calls up and says, "Hey, we're scuffling. We need you." And Willie said, What do you mean you need me?" And they said, "Well, we need you." He said, "Oh." So he goes to New York and struggles early on. But it's amazing that he would rather have stayed in Minneapolis than go up to the big leagues. But that was Willie. He made the best of everywhere he went, and that includes minor leagues, and that includes the Negro Leagues, major leagues, New York, San Francisco, Candlestick Park, the Polo Grounds, not exactly hitter-friendly ballparks.
You have said the most telling comment that you had in talking to Willie over the many interviews you had with him was how he came close to maybe walking away from baseball. And when I read your comment about that, it gave me goosebumps. Can you repeat it?
Wow. Well, yeah, those early days with Trenton, I'm sitting in the room with him, and he's reflecting back on how tough it was. And he was saying, "I went to my own hotel. I went to my own restaurant. I was by myself, except for when I was on the field." He said nice things about his white teammates, but at the time he couldn't even stay at the same hotel, go to the same restaurant, or dress at the same quarters. I mean, it's just, are you kidding me? And Willie looks at me and says, "I wondered if it was all worth it." And I'm all, "Whoa, what? I'm wondering if it was all worth it." And I'm imagining baseball and life in America without Willie Mays. What if it wasn't worth it? What if he gave up and went back to Birmingham and went into the mills like his dad was doing and worked odd jobs and never heard of Willie Mays? But luckily, for the good of the world, Willie Mays told himself it was worth it. All the abuse and crap that he took, he just persevered and overcame and moved on and made the best of it, like I said, and then better days were ahead. But there was a lot of nonsense that he had, that, like Mickey Mantle, for instance, who had a parallel path to Yankee Stadium, same age, broke in the same year, you know, also didn't have a lot of money growing up, but no way did he experience what Willie Mays experienced, because Mickey was white and Willie was black. But thank goodness it was worth it for Willie Mays and all of us.
When I listen to you and I think about Willie and a couple of conversations I had with him over the years, I think about a young black kid coming out of Alabama going to a metropolitan city like New York City. What was that transition like for him?
Well, it was tough, and thank goodness for Monty Irvin, because, you know, who lived in New Jersey and took Willie under his wing, and they were roommates on the road. And Monty was several years older, 30 at the time, I think, when Willie broke in. And he was like a father to Willie. You know, if not for Monty Irvin, you know, who knows what would have become of Willie, because he just told him, here's where you go, here's what you do, here's what you don't do, here's where the path you take. And from there, you know, life lessons, you know, here we go again. And that's what it's all about. I mean, just learning from older guys and then passing the baton on to younger guys. You know, you talk to Joe Morgan and Frank Robbins, even Hank Aaron, who's only 3 years younger, Maury Wills, Reggie Jackson, all these guys have stories, George Foster, about what Willie did for them that, you know, I never knew about, people didn't know about, because Willie, you know, didn't preach or brag. And it's wonderful to know the stories now.
I know that, as you indicated, he struggled at the beginning of his career, but Bill Rigney told me a wonderful story. When Willie had become a star in New York, every time they would play the Dodgers, that he lived in a little rooming house, and next door was a store, a little small store. And he said when he came home, there would be lots of people sitting on the steps and out in front of the store and everything. He would go upstairs into his room, and then he'd look out the window, and they'd all be gone. And he didn't understand what that was about. Mm-hmm. And Rig told him, he came in and he mentioned it to Rig, and Rig started laughing and said, "Don't you know what that is?" And he said, "No." He said, "We're playing the Dodgers." And he said, "They wanted to know what time you got in." So they knew how to bet on the game.
That's pretty good. And, you know, there was the Red Rooster and a couple other bars, yeah, or clubs. And even the bartenders looked out for him and stopped serving him with his favorite Coke and a cherry, like at 9 o'clock. So it's, and then the person, the other lady that he lived with, who oversaw the rooms, made sure that Willie was lights out at 10 o'clock, you know. They didn't have night games. So everybody was looking out for him, and that included the entire community of Harlem.
I have a line here in front of me that I think is so apropos to Willie, and I'm just wondering, when you hear this, tell me what you think and what did he think about this. He first captivated the baseball world with his unparalleled combination of skills, flair, and joyful exuberance.
Willie was more than a ball player. He was an entertainer, and he played for the joy and the thrill of the game. And yeah, it was a business, and it gave his aunts and his father extra cash and his mother as well. And he put some coins in his pocket. But once he got on the field, he tried to entertain you. He intentionally did things to want you to come tomorrow and pay again and enjoy the show again, and thus the basket catch, thus the cap flying off. You know, the basket catch goes back to his military days when, you know, after his rookie season, he goes into the military the following May in 52 and is in the military all the way beyond the 53 season. So he shows up in 54 with this basket catch he sort of created while playing ball in the Army, and Leo Durocher said, "What the heck is that?" He said, "Well, I'm catching the ball a new way." He said, "Well, you better not drop it or I'll fine you $50. And Willie remembers dropping two of them. And we looked it up, actually, 1955 and 10 years later, E8, E8. But those, otherwise, it's a pretty good fielding percentage. And he had 7,000 putouts, the most of any outfielder in history. So he was pretty good tracking the ball. And if Leo let it slide. But it was all about entertainment. And, you know, obviously, the cap flying off, he wanted a cap size too small because that, you know, fans dug it. It was a cool thing. But the basket catch, he sat and explained to me the benefit and the advantage of a basket catch rather than the old approach, two hands over your head. And I said, "What are you talking about, Willie?" And he said, "Well, the fact that you could get it quicker from glove to hand allows you to get the ball back to the infield. In other words, if you catch the ball up here, now you got to bring it all the way down. Now you got to step and crow hop and throw. But if you catch it down here, all you have to do is step and throw. I said, my goodness, why doesn't everyone do it? He said, I would not teach anybody to do it, and don't try it at home, because the next kid who tries, you're going to get hit in the head and blame me.
We only have 40 seconds before we have to break again, John. But the catch over the shoulder in that big game, he said to me one time, that was not the best catch I ever made.
Yeah, I don't think it's in his top two or three. Vince Scully says the greatest catch he ever saw, and Mays ranks it number one, is the Bobby Morgan catch at Ebbets Field early in his career, bases loaded in the eighth inning, and Carl Erskine on the mound for the Dodgers, and he thinks he's going to beat the Giants here, and if you look it up, he's got a winning record against every team but the Giants, but it didn't happen on this day because Mays, with the bases loaded and two outs in the eighth, makes a diving catch of Bobby Morgan's lining ball into the left center, it would have been off the left center field wall, but Mays caught it with a dive, knocked his head against the wall, got knocked out, and rolled over, and Hank Thompson, the left fielder, comes over and picks the ball out of his glove, shows it to the umpire, you know, third out, and preserved the tie. But, yeah, he made some wonderful catches.
John Shea is with us. We're talking about his book along with Willie Mays. They co-authored this book. It's called 24. We continue with more of you on America's Sports Talk Show. John Shea is with us. He and Willie Mays have gotten together to co-author an outstanding book about Willie's career and some of the things that he believed very strongly in. It is called 24. Let's talk about Jackie Robinson for just a second. He adored Jackie Robinson, and Mays looked to Robinson as a role model and perfect choice by Branch Rickey to break baseball's color line. Tell me more about that relationship and story.
Yeah, you're right. He did adore Jackie Robinson, and when Willie was a kid and Branch Rickey signed Jackie to play in 1946 for Montreal, the Triple-A team of the Dodgers, Willie's dad came to him and said, now you got a chance. And Willie said, what do you mean I got a chance? He said, now you got a chance to play in the big leagues because Jackie Robinson's going to open the door for you and other people. So Willie took it seriously. He thought the end of his career was going to be with the Birmingham Black Barons, which was going to be fine for him. But now a black man is heading to the big leagues, and that gave Willie a chance. You know, Jackie pretty much opened the door for all these guys, but it was, you know, Willie and Hank Aaron who just broke it down and became superstars, you know, the biggest players in the game, you know, post-World War II at a time where baseball was huge, king. And it was Mays and Aaron who led the way. But in 1964, Jackie, who retired before the Giants and Dodgers moved west in 58, so he was long retired. But in 64, he wrote a book, an oral history. And in that book, he asked many major leaguers, black and white, to weigh in on their thoughts and experiences of integration and their baseball lives. And the name of the book was Baseball Has Done It. It was an oral history. But Mays didn't want to do that. He didn't want to get involved in that stuff. You know, like his dad always said, you know, just keep that stuff down. You know, don't pop off. Don't make a stink. But this is 1964. This is, you know, Willie's well into his career, an accomplished superstar. So Jackie was very critical of Mays in the book and said, wouldn't we love to hear from this young man who lives in a big house in San Francisco, who has cash and made it big, you know, from, as he said, the slums of Westfield, Alabama. But those words were hurtful to Willie. And, you know, the story kind of went away, and everyone believed that, yeah, Willie didn't do enough for the black cause, because that's what Jackie Robinson wrote in the book. So I said, okay, let me write that down, and I'm going to go around and ask, you know, Maury Wills and Reggie Jackson and Frank Robinson and Hank Aaron and, you know, so many of these people I spoke to, you know, Joe Morgan, you know, for the book, Bob Kendrick, the Negro League Hall of Fame president, even Bill Clinton, you know, who grew up idolizing Mays. You know, as a 10-year-old, he saw Mays in a black and white TV his parents bought. There's one of the first things he saw on TV was Willie racing across his black and white screen. So Anyway, all these people tell detailed stories about how Willie actually was significant in the civil rights movement and was a big part of the African American cause, and diagramming why and explaining why. And Clinton was just wonderful. I mean, he said, Mays could change people with his indelible images. It's not just words. It's action. So, imagine Willie Mays, who's never booed at Ebbets Field or Dodger Stadium. He's loved by all. And, for the bigots out there, who found themselves rooting for Willie Mays and drawing to him because he's so good and so magnetic and so joyful and just the epitome of being a positive human being in this country. And now maybe hopefully they look in the mirror and ask, why am I being such an idiot? Why am I a racist? How could I root against Willie Mays, a black man? So Bill Clinton's quote, Willie Mays made it absurd to be a racist. And I said, oh, that's touching, beautiful stuff. So the chapter is, the story of the absurdity of racism, and it really hit home, I think, for Willie when telling these stories, and for others talking about Willie and his importance at the time.
You mentioned about 1958. That's when the Giants came west to San Francisco. How did he feel about that move?
Well, it's funny because his 89th birthday was the other day, and a day or two later, I was over at his house, and I actually asked him that. The topic came up. And I asked him if he actually missed, New York when he left for San Francisco, and missed San Francisco when he went back to New York, because he's been zigzagging here, and now he's back in San Francisco. And he said, when I left New York, it was tough because I just knew everything about New York and I knew nothing about San Francisco. And as the book suggests in the first chapter, San Franciscans loved Joe DiMaggio. They didn't know Willie Mays. They didn't appreciate it. And here's Joe DiMaggio's town. He's the center fielder we all love. He played at Seal Stadium. He's from San Francisco. And then Willie comes along, a 27-year-old superstar, the most exciting player in the game. And he's playing Joe's position in Joe's town at Joe's ballpark. So it took a couple years for a lot of San Franciscans, old-timers, to actually warm to Willie Mays. Can you imagine that? Now they have a statue in front of him, and the ballpark is at 24 Willie Mays Plaza. And then he goes back to New York, and that was one of maybe two regrets he mentioned in the book. One was not experiencing the college life, and one was getting traded to the Giants. He wanted to be a Giant his whole life. But obviously, Horace Stoneham, as the story goes, didn't have enough finances. Obviously, we know who got the best of that deal, the O'Malleys over Horace Stoneham. They got Dodger Stadium, and Stoneham got Candlestick Park. And he just didn't have the money to pay Willie's $165,000 contract. So he traded.
It's also said that when he came to San Francisco, he tried to buy a house in the Bay Area, and he ran into racism again. I was surprised to hear that. What's the story there?
Boy, that was something. December of 1957, he leaves New York and tries to buy a home in an upscale neighborhood in, San Francisco, of all places, right? You figure a black man could move into the city. Well, this was 1957. And the white owner and the white neighborhood didn't permit it right away. And Willie fought it, and the mayor came in, and he didn't want this to happen, but it became a national story once the local press got a hold of it. And it became a national story, and it was really an embarrassment to the city of San Francisco. But Willie kept pushing, said, no, I want this house. And not just for me, but for the next guy who wants to move here. That's what he was thinking. So the next day, the owner and the neighbors, fall back and realize their stupidity and say, okay, yeah, please move in. And so Mays moved in, and about a year and a half later, some idiot threw a racist note in a bottle through Willie's front window. It's just crazy to hear about this stuff in 2020 when you're talking Willie Mays, the ultimate peacekeeper, the ultimate uniter. He was the man who dragged Johnny Roseboro off the field when Marichal clubbed him, going over to the Dodger dugout among a sea of blue. Here's Willie Mays, the peacekeeper. And he did the same thing in the 73 playoffs, when Pete Rose slid into second base and he got in a big fight, and they were throwing whiskey bottles at Pete Rose and left field at Shea Stadium, and it was Mays and a couple others who went out there and told the fans to cool it. And if Willie Mays tells you to cool it, you cool it.
John Shea, the co-author, along with Willie Mays, talking about the book 24 Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid. He was always reticent to trust people. I found when I got to know him when I first came to San Francisco, and I had heard stories, he would be standoffish, and it was certainly understandable. But I found him as I went along in the years, as I'm sure you have since you've known him for a long time, that once he began to drop that guard and he knew he could be comfortable and safe, that he was really a very open, warm person.
Yeah, you're right. And I've heard interviews you've conducted with him over the years, and you could tell by the sound of his voice that he was very trusting of you. And that's the key. I mean, during his playing days, he had no agent. There was no players union. There was no free agency. It was basically, you go in there, talk to the owner, and, you know, I had a career year. Well, we'll give you a $5,000 raise, or we'll dock you $5,000 because you struck out more times this year than last year. And they had no power. And, you know, more than once, people took advantage of Willie, and, you know, he lost some money. You know, so obviously, who are you going to trust? You're going to trust the next guy who comes along and says, hey, I'll take care of your money? So Herman Franks actually helped him big time in the late 60s, his manager. So Willie invested properly, thanks to Herman, who was a genius with investing. And Willie bought a home in 1970 in a nice part of the Bay Area, still lives there today, beautiful home. And so he eventually did get some, you know, good backing and support. But, yeah, it's hard to gain his trust. And, you know, even me, you know, you're around for a long time, and it's just cool. You know, I never imagined writing a book with him, but I just wanted to hear his story. So you listen in the scrum, and you keep quiet and let him go. And then you start writing about him, and why wouldn't he, as the national baseball writer at the Chronicle? And then well, that's fair. Okay, I'll keep talking to this guy. So we kept talking, and I kept writing, and eventually, you know, like 15 years ago, I asked him about the book project, and now we have it today.
John, you're the perfect person to ask this question. 22 seasons in the major leagues, and everybody gets older, and you wonder how great athletes like Willie Mays handle the declining years and rushing toward retirement and everything. Give me some insight, because I've never heard how he felt about the end of his career.
Well, it was 1973 with the Mets, and he was going to be fine retiring after 1972. That was the year Joan Payson traded for him, and Joan Payson had partial ownership of the old New York Giants, and then sold that once the Giants moved west, but always loved Mays. Was like her all-time favorite player. Now she becomes majority owner of the expansion Mets, and in the early 70s, finds a way to get Willie back to New York. So she sends, Charlie Williams and cash for the great Willie Mays. And Willie had a pretty decent year the first year. I think his OPS was the highest on the team. And I talked to Crane Pool and Kuzman and all these old Mets who just absolutely loved him there. But now go to 73, his final season. The first time in his whole career he's on the disabled list. He has shoulder, he has ribs, he has knees, all kinds of physical issues. He wanted to retire the year before, but Joan Payson wouldn't let him. So, okay, I'll play another year. I'll help the guys. So he missed most of September, and then the Mets made this crazy run to overtake the whole pack in the division. They were in last place in August, and they win the division. It's a miracle ending. And then, you know, they beat they win the first round, the Reds, and then they play the A's in the World Series. And Willie hadn't started a game in weeks, but Rusty Staub has a bum shoulder, so Yogi Berra starts Willie Mays in game one. He goes 1-for-4, gets a knock, and the Mets lost, but in game two. So that's the game everybody talks about. Okay, you look at the film, you look at the video. Willie stumbled in the outfield. You don't want to be Willie Mays. You don't want to play too long. You want to get out of the game while you're still at the top of your game, and all these examples. Well, I investigated that game and talked to Reggie Jackson, the opposing center fielder, and Ray Fosse, the catcher, and all of Willie's teammates and opponents to see what about Willie. And Reggie called it. And by the way, that game two went extra innings, and Willie got the game-winning hit. But what they remember is, well, Willie Mays fell down. I mean, he could have fallen down at age 25 and nobody would have thought about it. But now he's 42 and fell down and said, oh, you don't want to be the next Willie Mays. But the stunt was absolutely brutal. Reggie said it was the worst he's ever seen it. And I went back to see that whole game. Everything in the air, every pop-up, every fly ball was an adventure. And sure enough, you know, Willie goes out there. He wasn't, you know, directed to play center field right away. He thought he was going out to right field because Don Hahn, you know, Willie entered late as the pinch hitter and got that big hit. Don Hahn played center field. But then both of them went out to right, and then Willie looks in the dugout, and they signal him, no, you play center. So it's the first time in weeks, you know, that he gets any kind of tough ball. And, you know, Darren Johnson hit a shallow base hit, and Willie, you know, reached for it and then fell over, and the ball went by him. And then later in the game, Willie is arguing a call at the plate, and we all see these pictures of Willie on his knees and his caps off and his arms in the air. Well, it's not because Willie struck out or made a bad play. It's because he was defending his teammate.
John, you did a great effort, and, of course, Willie as well. I'm glad you two combined forces. This is probably the best book I'm going to read. It's called 24 Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid. Thank you for sharing those memories and your experiences with him, and him sharing with everybody else his experiences as he was growing up. So again, thank you very much. Take care.
Well, thanks, Ron. That means a lot coming from you, who has a nice relationship with Willie over the years. It was a pleasure and an honor to talk to you and to write about the great Willie Mays.
John Shea. We continue with more of You and Sports Byline.